Please be seated. We'll call our next case, which is case number 60676, Michael Richmond et al. Versus District Court, and Haynes and Krieger as the real party in interest. Okay, Mr. Marks, you may proceed on behalf of the petitioner.
Thank you, Mayor. Please, the court. This case on its face is about the difference between the rule regarding former clients and prospective clients, 1.18 and 1.9. But in the real world, the question is, how can our law firm be disqualified when we never met Haynes and Krieger, we never spoke on the phone to Haynes and Krieger, we never received a letter from Haynes and Krieger, we never received a fax or an email from Haynes and Krieger, or any document? The district court basically adopted...
Did you show a purported complaint in this matter?
Excuse me?
A proposed complaint that named them?
We sued Haynes and Krieger on behalf
That's
of...
That's not what I asked you. The question was, when the interview took place, didn't you receive a proposed complaint?
Correct.
That had them in the title.
Correct.
At least. Okay.
But we never... Mr. Levine had a conversation with a gentleman, Fenton Howard, who indicated they didn't know who was representing Haynes and Krieger. In fact, a different law firms represented Fenton Howard as Haynes and Krieger. At the time of the interview, it was a new client sheet filled out in her office that listed who's the client. It was Fenton Howard. Who's paying the bill? Fenton Howard. They never told Mr. Levine, in none of the affidavits they filed in this case, they ever tell Mr. Levine, we are here as agents of Haynes and Krieger to hire Haynes and Krieger.
Do they have to do that in order to reach the standard for a consideration of disqualification? I mean, they don't have to actually say that, do they?
I think they do, because this is really a phantom rule. This is a phantom client rule. Basically, Rule 1.18 has never been interpreted this way in Nevada or anywhere in the country. Your cases that were cited by the district court, in effect, support our view, the Brown case and the Robbins v. Gillick case. If you go back to the Robbins v. Gillick case, you all know Jerry Gillick. He represented Dr. Robbins in one case of medical malpractice, and a couple of years later he sued the same doctor in another case. And the rule, and so clearly he had an attorney-client relationship. So 1.19, the former client rule applies, and the rule is basically you can sue a former client if it's on an unrelated matter. It's clearly there's an attorney-client relationship, and then clearly there's a lawsuit. In the Brown case, you had a secretary who basically switched sides. There was another malpractice case representing one doctor, switching sides then to the plaintiff. They disqualified the attorney who she worked for, but they didn't disqualify the co-counsel, saying it was too attenuated and the defense counsel couldn't show that the plaintiff had received any confidential information. The district court just misinterpreted what happened here. If you go back to the complaint that was reviewed by Mr. Levine, Merit Realty was suing Fenton Howard for adding Haynes and Krieger, but basically for activities that took place in the fall of 2010 when Fenton Howard worked for Merit Realty and basically took clients, escrows, real estate transactions to Haynes and Krieger Realty, a party that is not in our case. Our case was Michael Richmond in 2009 entering into a joint venture with Haynes and Krieger for loan modifications.
With what realty?
Excuse me?
With what realty agency?
Well, that's really not the issue. It was in 2009, Michael Richmond was a bankruptcy client of Haynes and Krieger. Haynes and Krieger approached Michael Richmond to join together to form basically Haynes and Krieger loan modification in 2009. Michael Richmond had no dealings with Fenton Howard. He had no dealings with Merit Realty. These are two totally different time frames, transaction frames, and lawsuits. Even if you analyze this under the Jerry Gillick standard, they're so totally unrelated. The only connection is Michael Richmond helped form the realty company in 2009. But he was basically gone by the time Fenton Howard came in 2010. Fenton Howard effectively replaced him. And the lawsuit that Mr. Levine looked at was Merit Realty suing for activities Fenton Howard did at Merit Realty. It had nothing to do with what Mr. Richmond was doing at Haynes and Krieger loan modification.
Mr. Marcy, we have a couple other issues here, and I think we understand your position on that. Let's start with screening, and I'd like to know if that was raised before Judge Corey in District Court. That is, if these people met with Mr. Levine and not with you initially, and I don't know if you were involved in the initial transaction, could the case potentially have been screened whereby if there was a problem, you could have handled it on behalf of Mr. Richmond and the other parties as opposed to Mr. Levine?
Right, and we argued the screening. We don't think Mr.
Did you argue that in District Court?
Yes, and we don't think Mr. Levine should be disqualified. We don't think you need it. And there's a lot of issues. Should there have been at least an evidentiary hearing? Again, that's an issue in the old builders case that if Judge Corey had any concerns, he should not have disqualified us. He should have had an evidentiary hearing. We don't think it should get to that point. We also argued that I could handle it and we could screen Mr. Levine. You're talking about 1.5 hour at most consultation with Fenn and Howard.
So make sure that was raised in District Court.
It was raised. They're arguing it was raised on reconsideration, but it was raised because we didn't think on the initial disqualification, we argued the merits that these rules. We think Judge Corey, if you read his decision, he used the former client rule 1.9, with all due respect. He didn't analyze 1.18. In our brief, we tried to show the main difference. In 1.18, the American Law Institute, the ABA, restatement has recognized you can't disqualify counsel on a half-hour consultation that you never met. You don't get the same protection as an actual client that you may live with for a year or 2 years. You may have lunches and dinners. If you're in trial with somebody, you'd be working around the clock with that client. That client deserves, and under all the rules, gets a lot more protection than somebody that calls up or you see on a half-hour basis on a consultation. And additionally, what if you have a situation where there's four defendants, and one person comes in, which is pretty typical when you practice, and says, I don't know if you could represent me or them, and at that point you're saying, well, you're here, I'm going to look at you. I'm not dealing with the them. You would be disqualified from filing a cross-claim against the them, the other two people who you never met and never saw. You wouldn't be disqualified. It's never been the rule. And if attorney disqualification extends to what they're putting on us, where does it draw the line on judicial disqualification of people that are not in front of you that claim later, I was secretly an agent for someone? How would you ever be able to deal with that concept if the person standing in front of you and representing, these are the parties that I'm representing, but now I'm secretly representing someone else? In Lapidus, which was decided while this was pending, Judge Harsey wrote the opinion that said, there's no appearance of impropriety standard for lawyers, which Judge Corey held us to, so I think it needs to be reversed on that basis. And in Lapidus, there was an attorney representing his dad against his mom. And you held there was no conflict there because there was no pecuniary interest. Clearly, they may have had discussions about law and life over the course of their life. It's a divorce case. Everything's at issue. There was no disqualification on that in that case. We brought that while this was pending to Judge Corey's attention, and he refused to change his mind on that opinion. So we don't think this was a close call. We think Judge Corey, in citing Brown and Gillick, those cases are cases where you didn't disqualify counsel. They don't stand for the proposition that we should be disqualified. The other issue is regarding the materials. They can't show that this one consultation provided information that could be significantly harmful in the instant Richmond case because there's no evidence that Fenn and Howard knew or heard of Richmond or knew of Richmond's deal with Haynes and Krieger or had any knowledge, percipient or otherwise, regarding that case. And they wouldn't have because they were in a totally different real estate company. These two cases are years apart. There's different parties, different issues. They never knew each other. They never spoke to each other. And basically, we believe that Judge Corey just totally used the wrong legal standard in disqualifying us.
Mr. Marks, let me ask you one other question. You raised the argument that there should have been an evidentiary hearing before Judge Corey on these issues, and he declined to give you that evidentiary hearing. I believe that's one of the points you raised on appeal. I'm going to reference a case neither one of you cited, but I just like how you feel like it may impact this case. It's a case called Bohena versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber. In that case, the discovery commissioner recommended striking a defendant's answer as to liability for discovery violations, but it went to trial on damages, and we concluded in the opinion affirming the decision that if the sanctions were not case concluding, which they were only as to liability, that the district court did not have to have evidentiary hearings. So this is not a case concluding case, but it's a totally different type of case involving attorney disqualification. So do you feel that case would have any impact on our decision here?
No, and for this reason. We don't think this is a close call. If you really look at the affidavits filed by Fenn and Howard, they're obviously carefully drawn by counsel, but they don't rebut Mr. Levine's affidavit. There's no confidential information. There could have been, common sense tells you, there could have been confidential information, because if you look at the Merit Realty complaint and you look at our complaint, you're going to see two totally different concepts. We didn't want an evidentiary hearing. We cited Old Builders out of New Jersey because the New Jersey Supreme Court said courts should be loath or careful to just knee-jerk disqualify people, especially dealing with prospective clients. They are one of the leading, it's one of the leading decisions on prospective client. There's just not that many cases across the country. And that case said if the judge has questions, then hold an evidentiary hearing and look at the credibility of witnesses if you don't think the affidavits are sufficient. We obviously think they are. But if there's a question on disqualification, and Judge Coy obviously had a question, we don't think he fully understood the two different concepts, two different cases, two different lawsuits that have nothing to do with each other, then he should have at a minimum held a hearing where Fenn and Howard would have had to come in and explain this, and Mr. Levine would have testified before he just knee-jerk disqualified.
Isn't he entitled to make the same call, if you will, using his judicial discretion that you've just made? You said that your affidavit, Mr. Levine's affidavit, clearly undercut the others. Now, isn't the judge entitled to use that same determination and therefore not be required have an evidentiary hearing? I mean, he can read the same documents.
Right, and we think if you read it, you conclude as a matter of law, Fenn and Howard don't say they were there for Haynes and Krieger, and that's the issue in the case. They won't under oath say that because it's just not true. They can't say that. But if the judge had a question, because you're on the motion calendar, you have people going right and left, you have a lot going on.
Well,
so if you're in that scenario and you're kind of trying to balance all the factors, you can only say, hey, let's have an evidentiary hearing and give it more time and attention. That's what the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled, because people, other judges, were using 1.9 in place of 1.18 because there was no law in 1.18. But if you look at the purpose, nobody in private practice would say you have the same duty to a half-hour consultant who never retains you that you would for a client that you're living with for years. It's just common sense as well as the rule. Unless there's any questions, I'd like to reserve the balance.
We have 2 minutes to reserve. Thank you very much. And, Mr. Kennedy, perhaps you talk about some of the cases that Mr. Marsh referred to. Generally, the case has been against disqualifying attorneys, but I know you have dealt with that very extensively, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
I have. And let me first just address some of the points that the court raised with Mr. Marks by its questions. First, Mr. Marks says there just isn't any evidence at all that Mr. Fenn and Mr. Howard met with Mr. Levine on behalf of all the named defendants. To the contrary, Mr. Fenn says in his affidavit, this is appendix, page 124, he says after he got the demand letter and the draft complaint from Mr. Arbaugh on behalf of Merit Realty, in paragraph 5, in response to this demand letter, Mr. Haynes and Mr. Krieger asked me and Mr. Howard to speak to counsel regarding the potential for liability of all named defendants. That's Fenn, Howard, Haynes, Krieger, and the entities. As a result, on December 17, 2010, Mr. Howard and I contacted the law office of Daniel Marks and met with Adam Levine. During this meeting, Mr. Howard and I provided to Mr. Levine a comprehensive explanation of the facts underlying the allegations in the merit action.
Let me ask you this. I don't know if this is in the record, but was there any money paid by these representatives to Mr. Levine for this consultation?
There was, Your Honor. They paid $250, and the uncontested, uncontradicted evidence is that Mr. Haynes and Mr. Krieger then reimbursed that money to Mr. Fentz. So the money was actually paid by Mr. Haynes and Mr. Krieger. Secondly, screening. Mr. Mark says, well, you know, we could have done screening, and we raised that at the district court. Well, that was raised at the tail end of an oral argument, but I'll give them this. They did mention it. The problem is that the rule 1.18, specifically deals with screening in this situation. 1.18D says you can screen if the lawyer who received the information, that would be Mr. Levine, took reasonable measures to avoid exposure to more disqualifying information that was reasonably necessary to determine whether to represent the prospective client. And, of course, that didn't happen here. It's the screening that's available, which, and we've all at one time or another met with a client and you had to say, now look, just tell me what I need to know to determine a conflict, or tell me what I need to know to see what the case is about, because I don't want to get myself disqualified. And if you do that, and then you end up later having a problem, the lawyer can say, who got the information, I specifically limited this and took reasonable precautions not to hear too much. Then I was screened, and I had nothing else to do with the case. The reason that won't work here is because there's no evidence that that happened, number one. And number two, Mr. Levine's on the complaint as one of the lawyers. So obviously he didn't do what the rule requires in order to do the screening. In fact, there was no effort made to do screening. And we know from this court's jurisprudence that in order to determine the sufficiency of a screening, one of the key components and factors is when was it done? Was it done right away? And if it wasn't done right away but was done sometime later, that defeats the effectiveness of the screening. So screening doesn't work here either. The argument is made that Liapis comes into play because in that case the court once and for all definitively did away with the appearance of impropriety requirement. And what they say is, well, that's what Judge Corey did in this case, was disqualified us on the appearance of impropriety. That's not in the order. His order does not rely on the appearance of impropriety standard. In fact, Judge Corey's order is a really flawless analysis of the evidence and the application of Rule 1.18 to that evidence. That's clear from the order, and it's also clear, as we point out in the brief, from the transcript of the oral argument, where several times Judge Corey says, well, but now wait a minute, under 1.18, it's different than 1.9 because there has to be some confidential or some information imparted that it might likely harm the party in this litigation. So he knew exactly what he was doing when he did the analysis. If you read the order, it is a very, very well-done piece of work on the evidence in this case in Rule 1.18. Finally, the Bahena case, well, I've got 2 points and then I'll try to summarize. In the Bahena case, the court did say you don't have to have an evidentiary hearing every time there is a dispute. And that is particularly true in the area of attorney disqualification. We cite several cases in the brief where courts, including the California Supreme Court, say, look, preferably you do this on the record. Only if the trial judge who sits there and looks at the affidavits and the evidence says, you know, I'm going to need an evidentiary hearing to resolve certain questions that I have to decide, then you do it and you have the evidentiary hearing. And the counsel's reading of the New Jersey case, the old construction case, where he says that that the court says, no, you should have evidentiary hearings, that's not what that case says. That's the dissent in that case says, I think we should have had one in this case. But the majority says twice, and then they say on the first page of the opinion, we also reaffirm strongly the preference that applications seeking attorney disqualification be presented in writing and that disqualifications decisions should be made on the papers presented, except, of course, when an evidentiary hearing is needed because the court is unable to determine the matter on the written record before it. Precisely what many years of this court's jurisprudence say. You don't have an evidentiary hearing on every controversy. Only when the trial judge says, I need it to resolve a question I can't resolve on the papers. Now, as to what happened here with Judge Corey on that point, Mr. Marks asked for an evidentiary hearing, but one thing he didn't do when Judge Corey said, I don't think we need one, there's no offer of proof. No one says, wait a minute, Your Honor, we have to have an evidentiary hearing because I believe that the evidence or the testimony at that hearing will show something that I can't present to you in the affidavits or in the written record. That never happened. What we had was an undifferentiated grievance saying, I need an evidentiary hearing. And Judge Corey said, I've got everything there is in this case here. The only thing that he didn't have, and he recognized it, is he didn't have any evidence or testimony as to precisely what was said by the client, or the prospective client, and precisely what was said by the lawyer. And we know that he didn't need that because of this court's teachings in Robbins versus Gillick and the cases that follow it, where the court said, look, and this is the great majority view in the United States, in a disqualification proceeding, what you're doing is trying to protect those confidential and privileged communications from coming out from the lawyer that heard them. What you don't do is then have an evidentiary hearing having the client and the lawyer reveal those things. In Robbins versus Gillick, this court said the trial judge should make a realistic appraisal of whether confidences might have been disclosed which would be harmful. Exactly what Judge Corey did in this case. And the transcript reflects a colloquy on this, and what Judge Corey says is, look, I'm not going to put somebody up here to say, here's what I confided in the lawyer and what the lawyer told me. What he did, and what is proper under the case authority throughout the United States, with a couple of exceptions, in this case what we had was we had the proposed complaint that Mr. Arbach sent to Fenn and Howard, and we had the complaint that was actually filed in this case by Mr. Marks and Mr. Levine. And Judge Corey, as we argued and we briefed, you take those two documents and you lay them down next to each other. And you say, we know it is undisputed that Mr. Fenn and Mr. Howard went to see Mr. Levine, and they had with them this draft complaint from Mr. Arbach. And Judge Corey said, well, I know what was discussed in that meeting, because Fenn and Howard said that's why we went to the lawyer. They got it on the 16th of December. They went on the 17th of December. Judge Corey essentially said, look, I know why they went to see him, because of this complaint, this draft complaint they got. They didn't go to see him for any other reason. So I can reasonably conclude that the substance of this complaint is what they discussed with Mr. Levine. It couldn't be anything else. And that's what Mr. Fenn says in his affidavit. That's why I went there, was to discuss this with him.
So, in fact, I did not misinterpret the record when I said to Mr. Marks that, indeed, the judge had before him not only the draft complaint, but affidavits that he could, as a judge is supposed to, evaluate for what was in those affidavits. That's how he made his decision.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Okay. Those were attached, they were attached several times to various affidavits of Mr. Fenn and others saying, these are the documents I took when I went to see Mr. Levine, because that's what was going to be discussed.
So is that a transcript of what happened in that meeting? You have enough based upon
that? Oh, exactly. And I might add, There are a couple cases. Rule 1.18, that rule was adopted in about 2000, was adopted here in 2006. So it's a pretty new rule. There's not a lot of jurisprudence out there. There are a few cases, and we discussed them. And what you see in several of these cases is you see trial judges in appellate courts struggling, saying, they had these conversations, but there's disputes about what was said. In the Maness case, which is the consultant for the nursing home, it involved guys playing golf together over several years in the trial court. I'm sure he was pulling his hair out, saying, he says, well, we discussed this, and the lawyer says, we discussed this, and now I have to sort and parse all of this out. That's not this case. We know what was discussed. We have the draft complaint that was taken to Mr. Levine by Mr. Shannon and Mr. Howard, so we know what they talked about. And what we said to Judge Corey and what he did was, we said, take that and look at the complaint that Mr. Marks and Mr. Levine filed in this case. Lay them side by side, and let's look at the similarities to see if under Rule 1.18 these matters are substantially related. Now, Mr. Marks says, well, Judge Corey got mixed up between 1.9 and 1.18. No, he didn't. He did what the other courts, in other opinions, have done, because there's an element in 1.9 and in 1.18 that's identical, and that is the same or substantially related matter. So what Judge Corey did was he said, well, there's not a lot of 1.18 jurisprudence out there, but this is a term that the Nevada Supreme Court has defined several times in the context of Rule 1.9. In fact, 1.9 is mentioned in 1.18. And he said, are they substantially the same or substantially related? Well, they're not the same, because they're two different things. Substantially related. He said, well, let's take a look at them. And of course, they are substantially related, and we laid this out in the brief. They arise out of the same transaction, the formation and operation of H&K Realty. H&K Realty was an entity that was formed to help people doing short sales. And the two cases, to summarize them, are this. In Mr. Arbach's case, the Merritt Realty case, he says, Fannin Howard left Merritt Realty, went with Mr. Haynes and Mr. Krieger, and formed H&K Realty.
Who is the broker of record of H&K Realty? Is that in the
record? I believe that's Mr. Fannin and Mr. Howard.
Okay.
And and Merritt Realty said, oh, you left us, you violated duties you owed to us when you went and joined up with Mr. Haynes and Mr. Krieger, you took confidential information, employees, and that sort of stuff. That was that case. In this case that Mr. Marks filed, Mr. Richmond says, no, that was my idea to form the short sale company with Haynes and Krieger. And Mr. Haynes and Mr. Krieger promised me that I was going to operate it. And what he says in paragraph 30 of this complaint, Mr. Richmond says, and they gave it to somebody else. Somebody else came in and was operating it. Well, of course, the somebody else is Mr. Fenn and Mr. Howard. So it's the same entity, the same transaction, with somebody saying it's mine and other people saying, no, it's ours. And Judge Corey looked at that and looked at the two complaints and said, you know what? I didn't need a lot more evidence to come to the conclusion that these are the same, or not the same, but these matters are substantially related. They arise out of the formation of the same entity. There's two lawsuits, basically where people are fighting over who gets the benefit or the ownership of it. In substance, Judge Corey did a very good job with a rule, 1.18, which for this state is new and there's been no jurisprudence on it. He certainly decided correctly, and in any event, did not manifestly abuse his discretion.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Would you add an extra minute, Tracy, to Mr. Marks' time, please?
Just to say that, first of all, we didn't sue Haynes and Krieger Realty. The issues in our case were in 2009, when Mr. Richmond helped form Haynes and Krieger Loan Modification. That's a separate entity, doing separate business in 2009. from what Mr. Kennedy is saying, if Fenn and Howe had walked in our office and they never told us they're there for Haynes and Krueger, Haynes and Krueger's a law firm. Some guy walks into your office, it's a real estate broker, you don't think he's the agent of the law firm, and he wants to sue Haynes and Krueger. We wouldn't be disqualified from suing Haynes and Krueger because later Haynes and Krueger says, we told him to go look at our liability. We have to look very closely at the affidavit because the affidavit was very tightly drafted by counsel, Appendix 124. It says by Mr. Fenn that Haynes and Krueger asked him and Mr. Howe to speak to counsel regarding the potential for liability of all named defendants. But he doesn't say, I told that to Mr. Levine. And Mr. Levine swears under oath, they never told me these lay people, were there for a law firm. Remember, the law firm was sued. This isn't about Haynes and Krueger Realty. In the Richmond case, our case here, we didn't sue Haynes and Krueger Realty. We sued Haynes and Krueger, the law firm, who was the attorney for our client, Mr. Richmond, in 09, before any of this merit stuff ever happened. And we sued Haynes and Krueger Loan Modification, which my client had a joint venture. There's no prohibition against the fact that two competing plaintiffs, say Haynes and Krueger, formed actions with them and were disqualified because Haynes and Krueger secretly had a secret deal again with Fenn and Howard. If you look at the appendix, 183, we have a new client sheet. It says, who's the client? Adam Fenn. Who referred you? Jeff Winchester. He's an attorney at Ogletree who does employment law. He occasionally refers, you know, plaintiff disputes to us. What's the nature of the dispute? Real estate dispute of commission. That's not the Richmond case.
And the fact that a complaint came in with those prospective clients is of no import to this discussion.
It's not of no import. We have to balance that against, we asked who's responsible for the bill. He says, Adam Fenn. We asked who to be contacted if he can't be reached, Ryan Howard. Haynes and Krueger's name doesn't appear anywhere in the new client sheet. Mr. Lynn swears they never said we're here to hire an attorney. If somebody came in and told me, I'm really here for a law firm, I'd probably try to get on the phone and find out, is that really true? Because it's hard to believe a layperson is going to hire me to represent a law firm when we all know the professional rules. It's questionable whether that can be done. They're not principals. They're not agents. There's no way we could ever know that was going on. So if you really look closely, these affidavits were really tailored to avoid the real elephant in the room is that Haynes and Krueger were never a client. And if they were never our client, none of this matters. They don't go to any of these rules. The only way we would be disqualified is if you believe first, Haynes and Krueger is our client or prospective client, which we vehemently dispute. And then the two cases are the same or similar, which they're not. If you look at these complaints, the fact they're suing about real estate deals or loan modifications, it's they're years apart.
Thank you, Mr. Marks, very much. And we'll take the case under submission. And Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Marks, Mr. Levine, thank you for being here. We appreciate your fine arguments and briefs. And we will get a decision out as soon as we can.